Okay, so we're here for our second preparatory session before our trip to Germany, and our focus is on the early modern period. Particularly, we're going to be focusing on the life of Moses Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn was probably the single most important transitional figure in 18th century German Jewry. And by looking at his story, we'll hopefully have a window into some of the changes that were beginning to impact German Jews in the late 18th and into the early 19th century. So in the 1700s, there were probably no more than 60,000 Jews living in Germany. 60,000 Jews. Remember, there is no country called Germany at this time. There are about 100 different independent states. Some of them are just city-states that make up what we would call Germany. The Jews probably made up about half of 1% of the population. Now, that number will grow over the next century. Even at its height, German Jewry will remain at probably no more than about 1% of the German population. Okay? So even when we're talking about, you know, the interwar years, when the Jewish presence in Germany in economic life, in political life, in cultural life, in scientific life is very, very pronounced and very prominent, the Jews are only 1% of the German population. Of course, this magnification of the Jewish presence in Germany in the late 19th and early 20th centuries is a double-edged sword for the Jews of Germany. On the one hand, it's a source of great pride, how many German Jews won Nobel Prizes and how many of them were prominent in the economy and in the arts in Germany. On the other hand, it works against them too, eliciting feelings of envy and resentment by the non-Jewish population. By magnification, I mean the prominence, the extreme prominence of Jews relative to their numbers in the total population. Mendelssohn is the first of a long line of German Jews who feel deeply attached to German culture and struggle to remain, on the one hand, a loyal Jew, whatever that means, because it means different things to different people, and yet to be acculturated into Germany, and that struggle foreshadows the lives of many German Jews over the next two centuries. There's a book that I recommend that you might want to read before we go, The Pity of It All by Amos Elon. And the subtitle of it is A Portrait of the German Jewish Epoch, 1743 to 1933. Really, we are at the beginning of that period now when we speak about Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn is a philosopher, and he is perhaps the most important early figure of the movement that we call the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment of the 18th and 19th centuries, meaning the exposure of the Jews, not only of Germany, but of all of Europe, over the course of the 18th and 19th centuries, to Western culture. He himself was a practicing Orthodox Jew, but he is considered by the Reform Movement to be the founder of the Reform Movement in Germany. He was called in the press and by many German intellectuals at the time, the German Socrates. And he became a model of a German Jew who made it in general German society. Mendelssohn comes from a poor family from a town called Dessau, D-E-S-S-A-U. His father was actually a Sofer Stam, who wrote Sefrei Torah, and was quite poor. And in this sense, Mendelssohn was typical of 18th century German Jews who lived, for the most part, from hand to mouth. One source that I saw estimated that 80% of German Jews in the 1700s were living from hand to mouth. His father's name was Mendel. Hence, Mendelssohn took the name Mendelssohn, right? Son of Mendel. Moshe, son of Mendel. His early education was by his father, who was a sofer and an educated man, and also the local rabbi in Dessau, whose name was David Frankel, who not only taught him Tanakh and Talmud, but also taught the young Mendelssohn the Rambam. And from there begins his love of philosophy. Mendelssohn knew only Hebrew and Yiddish as a young man. He was destined for a rabbinical career. And he followed his rabbi, David Frankel, to Berlin in 1743. And I want to read to you from Amos Eilon's book how Mendelssohn arrived at the gates of Berlin in 1743. In the fall of 1743, a 14-year-old boy entered Berlin at the Rosenthaler Tor, the only gate in the city wall through which Jews and cattle were allowed to pass. The boy had arrived from his hometown of Dessau, some 100 miles away in the small independent principality of Dessau-Anhalt. For 5 or 6 days, he had walked through the hilly countryside to reach Berlin, the Prussian capital. We do not know whether he was wearing shoes. It is more likely he was barefoot. The boy, later famous throughout Europe as the philosopher Moses Mendelssohn, was frail and sickly, small for his age. Early years of poverty had left him with thin arms and legs, an awkward stutter, and a badly humped back. The hump may have been the result of a genetic disorder, or it may have been caused by rickets, a common childhood disease at the time. The boy was all but penniless and traveled alone, carrying his few possessions in a satchel on his hunched back. In 1743, the movements of Jews, many of whom were wandering peddlers, were tightly regulated and controlled. Only a limited number of rich Jews and occasionally a scholar were allowed to settle in Berlin. But peddlers were barred. Jews requesting admission to Berlin, even only for a few days, were sternly interrogated as to their background and purpose. The gatekeeper's surviving log for 1743, the year Mendelssohn trudged through the Rosenthal Gate, includes this notation, quote, "Today there passed 6 oxen, 7 swine, and a Jew." So this gives us a little bit of a picture of the place of the Jew in Berlin, in Germany, in the 1700s, the Berlin that Mendelssohn came to. The Berlin that he came to was physically a city surrounded by a wall, which had outside of it many forests and lakes. It was the capital of one of those 100 independent states called Prussia. One estimate that I came across was that there were 100,000 people living in Berlin at the time, making it a very large city in Europe. Of these, the estimate is that 25,000 of them were soldiers, a full quarter of the population. Prussia was a very militaristic state. Jews probably numbered about 2,000, about 2% of the city of Berlin. Again, 0.5% of all of the German states, 2% of the city of Berlin. Unlike most German Jews, whom we characterized as being rather poor, 2/3 of the Jews of Berlin were probably very well-to-do. That's the way they got to live in Berlin. You could only live there. You only got permission to live in the Prussian capital if you could prove that you were wealthy and useful to the Hohenzollern dynasty. In fact, until 1669, which is only about 80 years before this, Jews were not allowed to live in Berlin at all. But by the time Mendelssohn arrived in 1743, Jews were allowed to live in Berlin on a temporary basis. They actually had to renew their permit every year. And they had to pay an annual poll tax and other discriminatory taxes. For example, when a Jew left Berlin to travel, he had to pay a tax. When he married, he had to pay a tax. When his wife gave birth, he had to pay a tax. I'm using the male pronoun here because the tax was on the man and not the woman. Their right to live in Berlin could be revoked at any time. These were called Schutzjuden. S-C-H-U-T-Z-J-U-D-E-N. Schutzjuden, meaning protected Jews. They were not allowed to pass this right on to their children, only to their eldest son. Other children of these Schutzjuden, these protected Jews living in Berlin, had to pay a very heavy tax in order to remain in the city, 10,000 thaler. Thaler was the currency at that time. I have no idea what a thaler is worth, but 10,000 of them was probably a considerable sum of money. The first synagogue in Berlin was only allowed about 50 years after the Jews were allowed to live in Berlin. Of course, the king sold, quote-unquote, this right, this privilege to the Jewish community for a very hefty payment. In addition, the shul had to be inconspicuous in height. Under Frederick the Great, the Jews accounted for 37 out of 46 of the factories in Berlin at the time that were established during the reign of Frederick the Great. So you can see the economic usefulness of having these Jews. I want to read to you one more piece from Amos Elon's book, The Pity of It All, which he describes one of the interesting, I don't know whether to call it a tax or economic burdens that Jews in Berlin had to bear. It says, until 1812, this was in force, when the royal porcelain manufacturer, in unsuccessful competition, fell on hard times. The king decreed that Jews had to buy 500 thalers worth of his porcelain on marrying, 300 thalers worth on the birth of a first child, 500 on the birth of a second, and 300 on the purchase of a house, this obligation being over and above other duties payable on such occasions. In other words, Jews were forced to buy from the royal porcelain factory because the royal porcelain factory wasn't doing well. So Jews had to buy porcelain on these various milestones in their life. But worse, they could not choose the plates or cups they liked or that they needed. They had to take the factory's pick. The factory, of course, used the opportunity to rid itself of unsold merchandise. Moreover, such forced purchases could be resold only outside Prussia. They couldn't just turn it over and sell it to the next door neighbor. They had to sell it outside because they wanted to artificially subsidize the royal porcelain factory. The four sales continued until Frederick's death were rescinded by his successor only after a payment of 40,000 thaler to compensate him for the lost income. So you understand the dynamic of how the Jews were being used in Prussia. Yes, Kara. Well, we already saw that 37 of the 46 factories established under Frederick the Great are owned by Jews. Most of them are in business, and most of them are earning well, but paying a lot and also adding to the economy a lot.
But when they moved into Berlin,
right.
They had to be bringing their wealth.
That's right. They had to have made their fortune elsewhere. They could continue to make it in Berlin, but they had to come with a considerable amount of money. They were tolerated for their economic utility. Unlike in other German cities at the time, there was no ghetto in Berlin. The young Mendelssohn comes and begins to tutor the children of a wealthy Jewish silk merchant by the name of Isaac Bernhard. Mendelssohn won the confidence of this silk merchant, who not only makes him his bookkeeper, but eventually makes him his partner in the silk business. Mendelssohn was introduced in 1754 to a famous German writer by the name of Gotthold Ephraim Lessing. This was a writer who becomes a very close friend of Mendelssohn, writes a very important play called Nathan the Wise. In this play, a Jew is portrayed in a very heroic, positive manner, and it becomes a very big hit, this play. Nathan the Wise is really Moses Mendelssohn, is modeled on Moses Mendelssohn. And Lessing was really making a statement about how Jews could contribute with their wisdom to German society and should be granted equal rights. Of course, it would take another full century for that to actually happen. But Mendelssohn later will play a role as well in encouraging another prominent German, von Dohm, D-O-H-M, to publish in 1781 a treatise advocating the granting of equality to the Jews. So this was one of the things that Mendelssohn was working on. One of his agendas was to try to bring about the emancipation of German Jewry. Mendelssohn's rise to prominence in German intellectual circles is best seen in 1763, when he won the prize of the Berlin Academy in metaphysics. Coming in second was Immanuel Kant. So it gives us a sense of where Mendelssohn was in intellectual circles in Germany. In 1763, that same year, the king granted Mendelssohn, but not his wife or his children, the privilege of being one of the Schutzjude, being one of the protected Jews, which meant that he didn't have to renew his temporary stay in Berlin all the time. Mendelssohn had another agenda, and that was to bring the Jews closer to German culture. And he does this, one way in which he does this is by giving them a translation of the Chumash, of the Torah, and some other parts of Tanakh into German. He translates it from the Hebrew to the German in 1783. His translation is known as the Biur. Biur, I'll write it on the board. Bet Yud Aleph Vav Resh, which means... What? No. Leva'er is to explain. It's the explanation is the name of this translation. And he wrote a commentary in German too. And it's a very traditional commentary. It's based on rabbinic writings and the traditional commentators and Midrash. His agenda is to try to help German Jews learn a proper German. Okay? Most German Jews at that time spoke Yiddish, and many were quite literate in Hebrew as a language of Chumash and of Torah. Mendelssohn also helps to found a school in Berlin in 1778, where both religious and secular subjects are taught. And that was, of course, a major pioneering breakthrough for German Jewry. Kant, he was close with Immanuel Kant. Kant praised him many ways. I'm not going to quote all of the praises of Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn, one of his arguments, he writes a book called Jerusalem, which is one of his arguments for the Jews to be granted emancipation in Germany. And his logic is that just as various countries have various forms of government, one is a republic and one is a monarchy, individuals also need to have different religions. And there's no reason for a state to try to quash that diversity. Rather, it should encourage that diversity. I'll read you one quote from his book, Jerusalem. Here he's writing it to the non-Jews. Brothers, if you care for true piety, let us not feign agreement where diversity is evidently the plan and purpose of Providence. none of us thinks and feels exactly like his fellow man. Why do we wish to deceive each other with delusive words? Allow people to have their own religious opinions and their own religious freedom. Moses Mendelssohn married when he was in Berlin. He had 6 children. Only 2 of them remained Jewish. The other 4 converted. Of his grandchildren, most of them were not Jewish, and all of his great-grandchildren were not Jewish. One of his famous grandchildren was Felix Mendelssohn, the composer. There were others, one who was a famous engineer, another one who was a famous banker. But 1871 was when his last grandchild, who was Jewish, died. And that was the last descendant of Moses Mendelssohn to practice Judaism. Certainly that was not something that would have made Mendelssohn happy. As we said, he was a practicing and believing Jew.
Why do people think that so many of his children converted out?
So Naomi asks a good question. Why did so many of his children convert out? It's not only Mendelssohn's children. It's not only this family. Tens of thousands of German Jews convert to Christianity during the period of the 1800s and into the early 1900s. That is, the German Jewish acculturation becomes so successful that conversion and intermarriage, which we'll come to in a moment, become very, very common amongst German Jews. In 1933, the year Hitler came to power, one estimate is that 44%, that the intermarriage rate in German among German Jews was 44%, meaning 44% of all marriages involving a Jew in Germany in 1933 involved marrying a non-Jew. So these were not forced conversions. It's true that some of the, I shouldn't say it's true that some, I would say it's true that probably most of the conversions, not all, some of the conversions were undoubtedly people who really came to believe in Christianity and converted for religious reasons. Certainly many of the conversions were of a utilitarian nature. The most famous of them probably is Heinrich Heine. Heine, who's one of the great German writers of the 19th century, early 19th century, converts because he goes to law school, but then is not able to sit for the bar exam because he's Jewish. And so he decides to convert because his Judaism didn't mean so much to him and he wanted to be a lawyer. Of course, he didn't end up practicing law very much, but he converted. And Heine's writings are actually filled with Jewish references, and later in his life, from his letters and from his writings, it's clear that he regrets his conversion. But having said that, Heine converts, and he's not alone. We don't have an exact number, but we estimate the number is in the tens of thousands of German Jews who converted. So this is a significant part of the German Jewish population that converts, and a significant part that will intermarry as time goes on as well. The intermarriage is not as common in the early 1800s. It'll be much more common at the turn of the late 19th and into the early 20th century. Other questions that people have? Yes, Kara.
I'm curious how he transitioned into being so connected to German culture and learning German with his upbringing.
Ah, very good question. How was it that Mendelssohn managed to transition to become so fluent in German and learn all of these things? Mostly he was self-taught. You know, he learned, I have it here, he was taught mathematics by someone else, and a young Jewish physician taught him Latin in Berlin. But otherwise, he mastered Greek, French, and English, and German on his own. As an example, you know, one of the first things he did, he had very little money when he first came to Berlin, was he bought a copy of John Locke's essay concerning human understanding. And he mastered it with the help of a Latin dictionary. Right? He read it in Latin. Eventually, he mastered English too. So Mendelssohn clearly was brilliant, an autodidact in many ways, and I think for the anti-Semites, he was the exception Jew. For the liberal parts of Germany, Christian Germany, he was the potential Jew. For the Jews of Germany, for many of them, he was the model of how they too could make it in the general society. Yes, David.
You mentioned the word dynasty before, but I didn't hear what you called it.
The Hohenzollerns. Hohenzollern. It's a mouthful. The Hohenzollerns were the ruling dynasty in Prussia. Eventually, Prussia will lead German unification, which we finalized in 1871. The Kaisers, Wilhelm I and Wilhelm II, were from that Hohenzollern dynasty. Okay? So 1871, interestingly enough, is not only the year of German unification, but it's the year of the death of the last Jewish descendant of Moses Mendelssohn, his grandson. Any other questions? Yes. So he did not found Reform Judaism, but Reform Judaism in Germany looks to him as its founder, as its father figure, because there are certain aspects of Mendelssohn that were very much in common with Reform, not on the question of religious observance, but on the question of integration and acculturation into the general culture, in this case, German culture. In that sense, they look to him as the founder of Reform Judaism. But I think that Mendelssohn would probably be aghast if he would hear that, because even though he was against rabbinic coercion and rabbinic authority over Jews, which is something he had in common with Reform also, he felt that all Jews were obligated to observe the mitzvot, as he did, as he practiced, yes.
So, outside of Berlin,
yes.
How successful was Reform Judaism? And do we have a sense of percentages in terms of how many Jews identified as Reform?
So David asks questions about Reform Judaism. We will come to that in another lecture. We're going to be looking at the question of emancipation and denominations in our next session, which I think takes place on Wednesday. Is it Wednesday? On Wednesday. So then we'll be looking at emancipation and denominations, and we'll be talking about Reform in greater detail then, okay? Because Reform Judaism begins in the early 1800s. Again, our session today was about early modern Europe, about the 1700s, this transition of which Mendelssohn is the most important transitional figure in the modernization of German Jewry. Yes, Sarah.
Just to clarify, a lot of these conversions and interfaith marriages, were they taking place just in Berlin or all of Germany?
All of Germany. Question of conversions and intermarriages, we're talking not only about a Berlin phenomenon, but a phenomenon that existed throughout Germany. Okay? Now, the majority of Jews did not convert. The majority of Jews did not intermarry. But the figures that we have for conversions and for intermarriage are much higher than almost any place else, certainly that I've come across for this time period. Yes?
Do we know of stories of Jews who converted who continued to be persecuted?
Once Jews converted, they legally, they could no longer be barred from anything. However, just as in Spain, where many Jews converted in the late 1300s and early 1400s and into the period of the expulsion of 1492, and in Spain there was this concept of limpieza de sangre. My Spanish is not good, so purity of blood, where they began to persecute people who didn't have Christian blood going back many generations, which was actually against church doctrine, because if somebody accepts baptism, then he's to be considered a Christian according to the church. But it became a kind of racial anti-Semitism. There was something similar to that in Germany. Again, not church-sponsored, but rather popularly sponsored, that Jews who converted and were often in prominent positions in society were looked upon socially a little bit askance because of their Jewish origins. Okay? But that was, of course, inconsistent, you know, and depended on your social circle.
And when they were converting to Lutheranism or to...
It depended where they lived, a vast majority to Protestantism, which is the majority religion, Lutheranism in Germany, but some to Catholicism in southern Germany where that's prominent as well. Okay? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.